This morning, we hear from a gentleman who has coped with decades of physical and mental abuse from his wife, and a charming, charismatic woman who was a violent perpetrator. First Rose. She's 55, a mother of two. She spent 2 years in prison for grievous bodily harm. She spoke with Ginger Gorman about her family, her life, and her father, who started hitting her when she was 2 years old.
He would hit me so hard I would see stars, and that I remember that really clearly when I was a teenager, but certainly when I was little. My father's a big man. He's a big man. I was a little girl. So he would backhand me really hard across the head, and I'd see stars.
What long-term impact do you think that that has had on you?
Truthfully, I didn't realise it until now. I think that I'm quite knocked off because of it. I think I have... I think I have an intellectual disability because of it. I think that... but it's only in retrospect I can see it. Like, what will happen is that I get overwhelmed, my brain seems to short-circuit. Often if I get overwhelmed in some kind of emotional or physical situation and everything shuts down, I see red and it's all over Red Rover.
We're going to talk about your own violence in a minute, but the violence in your family didn't just come from your father. It was actually a wider thing in your family.
Yeah, it was. Look, I've just been back in New Zealand, and the thing that got me was how extraordinarily violent my family are, how they deal with things. They deal with things by shunning. It's really bad communication. One of the reasons that it's never been stopped is my family are, like, I guess, families that come from those kinds of, it's a very close system. It's insular. It's hierarchical, and everybody is dealt with within that hierarchy, and so police don't come in. Nobody intervenes in that. You know, I saw a lot of stuff there that shocked me when I went home, but that's because I've done a lot of work, for want of a better word, that made me be aware of what was going on. In the past, I've always, well, it was normal, you know, it was normal for me.
How did that upbringing of yours that you've been describing affect your first long-term relationship?
I went into that, this is retrospectively, I didn't know it at the time, because I think I went in it wholeheartedly thinking that I was, you know, sincere, but in retrospect what I can see is I went in shut down, ready to be, you know, unwilling to be taken advantage of, almost as if my partner was an enemy and I needed to keep my eyes open. In actual fact, I was living with him as if he was my father.
What happened in that relationship?
It got violent. Look, he wasn't the most communicative of people, and truthfully, neither was I back in those days. And we just never communicated either our needs or our what. Nothing. There was no communication.
Did you hit him first or he hit you?
I think if I remember correctly, he hit me first. But, you know, there was a lot of verbal abuse from me. There was a lot of me telling him, putting him down, telling him that he wasn't good enough, criticising him. So there was a lot of that from me. I remember the first time he hit me, he took the baby that we had out of my arms. That baby, by the way, is 32 today. That he took that baby out of my arms, put the baby down on the ground and then punched me.
When that happened, were you surprised, given your background?
Look, truthfully, I hit him right back. My automatic response was he hit me and I smacked him right back. And probably the only reason that it stopped was because our son was on the ground and we would have tramped on him. That's the only reason it stopped.
How long did you stay in that relationship?
Not too much longer. It was tense all the time. There was constant... there's constant tension with us. There was just constant tension.
How much understanding did you have of your own part in that situation?
Zilch, because from my point of view, I was right. That was the whole, you know, I'd seen my mother cop crap, and so my point of view was I was right. I had, from my point of view, I was like a soldier. I had to fight for what my rights were. I couldn't see it from a bigger perspective.
It sounds like you almost expected that in a relationship.
I don't know. I don't know what I expected from a relationship. I really genuinely don't know. I guess what I expected was, you know, what everybody expects when they walk in, you know, happy families, have children, happily ever after. That's really what I expected. It's not what I got, but that's what I expected.
But you did leave him.
Yeah, I did. I don't remember how old our son was. He was very young. He was still a baby.
How much later did you get into your second major relationship?
It would have been about another 10 years later. I got quite, if the truth be told, I was paranoid. I was afraid that I would partner with someone who would stand over me or my son, and I wouldn't have it. I wouldn't have... In retrospect, what I see is that I didn't want... I felt that if I wasn't careful, my son would be subjected to the same stuff that I'd been subjected to as a kid, and it never occurred to me, A, that that I could be in a relationship where that wouldn't happen, and B, that I actually would be the perpetrator of that.
That second relationship also turned out to be quite a damaging one. What happened there?
Same kind of thing. Bad communication. He came from an alcoholic family. I came from my, you know, less than stellar family. Bad communication, no communication. He was controlling. He was abusive. I was reactive, and it just went pear-shaped.
You ended up in jail because of something that happened with your second partner. What happened?
Long story short, I got into a punch-up with him, and his now wife got caught in between us, and when we came out of that fight, she had no ear, and her face was all beaten up. I mean, I got beaten up too, excepting that I think during that I went into blackout. I genuinely believe I went into blackout. He hit me in the back of the head, and all hell broke loose.
What do you think about when you think about that now, though? Because that's an horrendous thing to do, to, you know, take someone's ear off.
My experience, coming from a Maori family, a traditional Maori family, and having gone back and lived with the extended family, we're violent. We're verbally violent, we're emotionally violent. We're not just violent, we're brutal, and it's a given. So, you know, taking her ear off meant diddly to me. It was just business as usual. Like, you punch me, I have to fight to save my life. And if you get hurt, well, tough titty.
Once you were in jail, though, you must have reflected a little bit on what was happening in your life and the things that you had done that had brought you there.
No, it's not that I'm not intelligent. I just never had access to any other way of knowing. And truthfully, my perspective was, like, it's a cultural thing too. So I come from a culture that's macho and tough and hyper-masculine. I come from a family that's uber that. You know, I was raised to... You just take care of yourself. You don't. You take no hostages. You don't be a big crybaby. No, I didn't have that kind of. I still thought I was right.
But you really injured that woman.
I come from a background where, as a young child, I was beaten and harmed, and very few people came to protect me. So you touch my children, it's going to be on for young and old.
When you're in prison, they often make you do programs for anger management and that kind of thing. Did that happen to you when you were locked up?
No anger management, but they did have cognitive behavioral therapy, which meant diddly. They had a whole pile of us sitting in a big room, and some idiot from corrections services who looked like who looked like she was a Presbyterian or something, Presbyterian Sunday school, with mints in, and try and tell all of us who looked like, you know, a bench from Once Were Warriors, would try and tell us about life, and we'd look at her like, you know.
That didn't help you?
Not at all.
When you got out, at some point you did start seeking help. Why did you do that?
I had very little access to my son. I had very little access to my son. I had very little access to myself. I went and I signed up to see a psychiatrist who told me that the first interview I had with her, she said, I think that it could be 6.5 years, maybe 7.5 years that I'll work with you. I nodded my head yes, but inside I thought, chances are a fine thing. And it was difficult. I saw her 2.5 hours every week, twice a week for 6.5, nearly 7 years.
But something was driving you to want to change in some way, was it?
No, truthfully, what drove me was that I wanted more access to my son, and if that meant I had to take myself off to a psychiatrist, well, that was what it was going to be.
What did that psychiatrist tell you about your behaviour and who you were?
She said after 4 years of seeing me that I was very shut down, that she believed I came from a chaotic background. I spent most of those 4 years questioning her forensically about the DSM-5. I asked her questions constantly. She said I was very shut down and that she believed I had complex post-traumatic stress disorder. I said to her, are you sure I'm not bipolar or something like that? And she said, no, you definitely have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Do you believe that?
Look, funnily enough, at the time, I thought she was full of it. I thought it was a white middle-class label. I didn't even believe in psychiatrists. I didn't think she could help me, but I was going to front up and do whatever I had to do. No, I didn't. But now I get it. It's taken me, 15 years to finally, for that to seep through into consciousness that, because I'm highly reactive to sound, I'm jumpy. If I knock something off, if I knock a glass off a table, I can catch it immediately. I've been told over and over and over by people that know me that I'm hypervigilant. I can go places and know where there's danger. I'm always switched on and looking for danger.
And you think perhaps that's from your childhood?
I know it's from my childhood. I know it's from my childhood.
You at one point sought out help for your violent offending. How hard was that to find someone to help you as a female?
It was a friggin' joke. I did a personal self-development course. I heard this guy be told he was a bully. I was shocked that he was told that. It occurred to me that I was a freaking bully because people had said to me for years, you're a bully. And I thought it was a cultural thing. I thought, no, my perspective was I'm straight, I'm direct. It never occurred to me that I was a bully. Anyway, I took it on board that I was a bully and I had a look and I was pretty shocked. I considered that I might be a bully, and considering I might be a bully, I started to look how that could be so. I was shocked. I went online, I looked, I rang services asking if there were, anger management courses for women. I was told no, nothing.
How did you find someone then to help you?
Well, I told a friend of mine, and her her partner worked in services for men, and that were running anger management courses for men. And he rang me and he offered me a placing separately from the men, but he offered me a placing with one of their violent offender counsellors.
You had to go to a men's centre to get help for your violent perpetrating?
No, I had to go all the way around the town, and then someone had to hear my story, and then they had to tell it secondhand to someone else who felt sorry for me and contacted me. And I mean, it was happenstance that I got it. Failing that, I probably would have had nothing. I would have. I was looking for books too. I was looking for any kind of resource that might help me get what was going on with me.
There is a cultural problem we've got, though, isn't there, whereby people think that women are not violent offenders.
Yeah, and that's a big frickin' joke, because I tell you what, I know a phenomenal amount of women, and if I lined them up, you wouldn't be able to tell them. They aren't the stereotype. They're little, they're tiny, they're blonde, they're pretty. And I've had conversations over the years with over 100 women that have talked about punching out their boyfriends, their husbands, belting their kids. And you know, I started talking around about the time I was looking for someone to help me deal with my anger. I started talking to different women I knew, and all of a sudden, because I started talking about it, they started talking to me about it too.
If you look at the statistics, there are still more violent male offenders, perpetrators, than women.
Yeah, I guess that's what the statistics say, but I don't know, are they asking the women? And if they're asking the women, are the women being truthful? Because, you know, for a long time, there's a lot of DV in gay couples. But you never see any of that stuff show up in the statistics either, because they're not asking the right questions. If you presume the men, only the men, are violent, then why would you ask the women?
It seems to me that you somehow feel shut out of this conversation about domestic violence.
Oh, big time. Look, I think that the conversation has been hijacked by, I call them the whiteness, you know, white, male, female, the male feminists, the female feminists. Most of those ones are the intellectual feminists, because I know feminists who are like, they were feminists because they were being beaten and then they got the feminist moniker later, but actually what they are is very practical, pragmatic women. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the ones that have come along later that have, you know, it's a thing. It's like Sex in the City. It's a thing. And like, you know, it's like a groovy thing. And, you know, you get to get a big Twitter platform or a big Facebook, you know, social media platform, and you just become a freaking talking head on Q&A. And hell yeah, there are Aboriginal women that are outraged. Like Rosie Batty is like the big, you know, she, and I'm not diminishing what happened to Rosie Batty. What happened to her was shocking, and it was wrong, and it was crap. But I tell you what, way before Rosie Batty, there were 1,000 Aboriginal women that had happened to. There were Maori women, but you never saw any of us being used as the poster girl for domestic violence. Not at all.
What's your problem then with the way that white feminists, as you call them, are conducting this conversation at the moment?
It's too narrow. The conversation is too narrow, and it's not looking at, it's looking at, it's like he said, she said, you know, like, it's too simplistic. I tell you what, I think violence begets violence. I think violence starts, you know, there's a bigger conversation around domestic violence. But, you know, if you looked at domestic violence in terms of that it was a petri dish for psychopathy, a petri dish for long-term misery, like, you know, wholesale misery in the culture, man, they'd be getting onto it a lot quicker. And the thing for me is that while men are held, look, I'm not saying that men shouldn't be held to account, not frickin' at all, but you know what? There's a whole pile of other people suffering out there. I'm pretty damn sure there are men out there that are getting a frickin' hiding. There's probably a man listening to this now who's probably weeping in his kitchen because he's getting a hiding and nobody's speaking for him.
I can see that this is really upsetting you.
Yeah, really, for me, the whole conversation around violence, you know, people go violence and it's kind of tough, but violence is suffering. And, you know, I've suffered at the hands of my father, I've suffered at the hands of the person who molested me, I've suffered at the hands, and people have suffered at my hands too.
A tough conversation, Rose, talking with Ginger Gorman about her violence towards her former partners and other people in her life. You're listening to Life Matters. We're talking about men in violent relationships with female partners. Now, one of those people is Nick, who spoke with me a short time ago about his experiences. We've altered his voice to protect his privacy.
It started when we were dating. It was could be difficult. I guess the best way to describe my wife would be emotional dysregulation. So you have highs and lows. And after we were married, the lows started to turn into violence. About 6 months after, the highs and lows mean that the physical violence happens when you're right at the bottom. But in between, there's a spectrum of all sorts of other abuse.
Mm. And was there any actual violence before you married?
No. I wasn't being beaten up before we were married. Before we were married, it was more that small arguments became big arguments, and sometimes you're left bewildered as to what you've actually done wrong.
Mm. And what did you tell yourself about all of that?
I told myself that, okay, fair point. You know, it's the first time I'd been in a relationship with somebody, and trying to figure how I navigate all of that. You know? Mm. So you take it on board and you try and learn from it.
So you were trying to be constructive about it all. Can you remember the very first time she was violent, physically violent?
Yeah, we were living in a flat, and had this really awful acrylic bathtub. I could never seem to get clean, and you know, one Sunday night she said, you know, come here, the bath's not clean enough. And it just developed into this rage and started, you know, where I started to be hit in the face because of this perceived issue with how I had cleaned the bath. And that's how I remember that first time that I was physically assaulted.
Do you remember how you felt?
Ashamed. You know, it's just a shock and awe of how intense the whole thing was. And then the next day you begin to feel this, you know, seeping feeling of being totally and utterly ashamed that, you know, this person has beaten you up and there must have been a really good reason for it. And, you know, I started to believe in the propaganda that was coming my way, that it was all justified.
It's interesting, isn't it, that notion of shame. I mean, you've had somebody smack you in the face. You know, that's an assault. Was it like a psychological warfare as well with this idea of propaganda that somehow you were the one causing this?
Correct. The whole point of being somebody emotionally dysregulated is, I think, they're out of control and they need to control you. And they do that via psychological means and emotional manipulation just as much as they use it with physical violence. So they can never be wrong in that they have done this. It's always someone else's fault. And so to take the blame off themselves, they spend a lot of time reflecting it back or mirroring those feelings back onto you. You get lost in just the amount and the volume and the intensity of all that being projected on you.
And what else would trigger her?
My birthday, her father's birthday and death day, my family, contact with friends and family, Christmas, Easter. Easter is a really big trigger. For some reason, my wife will associate herself with the crucifixion of Christ. So for the week leading up to the crucifixion, it becomes steadily more and more intense and violent. And then on Sunday morning, she wakes up and it's just all gone. To me, it's a sign of just how the emotional dysregulation is functioning. And she's taking this guilt on board from a completely outside source and taking ownership of it and using it to drive her own feelings.
That first time she hit you in the face because of a dirty bathtub, what forms have the other assaults taken?
Punches, kicks, being knocked out. Hearing on one side is just ringing now after being hit in the side of the head. She's never picked up a weapon or a knife. Yeah, it's more hands and fists.
And is this in a frenzy that this happens over and over again in a short period of time, or how long does this go on for?
It usually is in very short bursts because she'll swap between character traits of literally laying on the floor, weeping, and then getting straight back up a few seconds later and is just a completely different person and she's into it. It's a rapid change of personality. So it tends to be very quick and intense. It's almost like a flash and then it's gone and reverts into something else.
And do you ever want to strike back?
I have. That was probably my biggest mistake. Is I slapped her back and I tried to restrain her wrists and I left bruises on her wrists where my fingers were. And the next day she's, look what you've done, I should go to the police with this. And it dawned on me just how much control she has over that particular situation. And I felt ashamed about it too because, a bloke my age is brought up to think that you should never hit a woman. And I had done the complete opposite. I had become like her. I had lost control.
Mm.
The physical things go away. It's more the psychological things that you carry around. You become hypervigilant of that feeling of walking on eggshells when you know that the wheels are about to fall off. And it can happen days in advance. You can feel that palpable tension in the air that it's coming. And you become to get into this frantic cycle of trying to avoid it, of doing absolutely everything you can to prevent it from happening.
Ever work?
Absolutely not. I've heard it described as you're trying to fulfill someone's emotional needs with a squirt gun, and their emotional needs the size of the Grand Canyon. You just can't do enough to fill that hole in that person.
You've got four children. How have they witnessed all of this?
Well, older children have, younger children not so much, because whilst you have big dips, you can also have highs and, you know, be a normal family for years even before the next outbreak happens. Or you begin to rationalise it yourself that, you know, it only happens a couple of times a year, it's all okay. The downside for me has been my older children are disassociated from their mother, so I have to fill the role of both mum and dad to them. My eldest child has had mental health issues and has at times felt suicidal. And getting access to support has been very difficult because he doesn't want to talk about his own feelings or about the troubles that we have at home. I think that he takes on board that it's shameful to talk about it. There's something wrong about talking about this issue.
Because it's domestic violence or because the woman is the perpetrator?
I think it's because the woman or his mother is the perpetrator.
Why do you stay?
For a long time, I was just completely bamboozled and thought that I could fix this, that it was my responsibility to take on board things and try and resolve them and try and be constructive within the relationship. And as a, they call it a fog, as you emerge out of the fog, you realise that when you ask for help, it's not there. And, you know, when I spoke to the police about taking an OVO out, they said that I would be removed from the home because, you know, that's the way things are done. I honestly felt there was absolutely nowhere for us to go. So the only solution, and, you know, you begin to think logically about it, is to try and stick it out and make it work. Because if I leave, I'll be leaving without my kids.
Well, that seems astounding that the police would say that a victim of domestic violence should be required to leave the home because an AVO has been taken out against his wife. When was that said to you?
It said a few years ago, and it's because unless the woman is showing violent tendency towards the children that can be proven, she will default with custody of the children. And if you and her cannot reside in the same house as per the AVO requirements, then you have to leave.
That seems an astounding attitude. What was the attitude of the police generally? I mean, I assume you went to the police at some point to report an assault, did you?
I was, at that particular point, I was asking them about how you actually go about getting an AVO and what would happen if I was in this situation. The one time they did ring the police, I stupidly thought it was so important. I actually rang the station house and said, I need some help, and it just didn't come. You know, the reality is I should have really rung 000. But, you know, you downplay it in your own head that it's not as bad as you think. And maybe that's why the police don't take it as seriously.
Has an officer ever explained to you his or her attitude to what you're describing?
No. When I have spoken to the police, it is just basically on the technicalities of how it would work. They haven't expressed their own opinions either way.
So you felt like you got no help from the police?
No help. I felt like I got no help from the police, but it for me it's been a common tale that there is frontline, first-level phone support available, but after that it just disintegrates into absolutely nothing. I have been to, was referred on by a GP to a domestic violence group in our state, and after agreeing to meet with me and conducting a session with counsellors, the counsellors turned around and said, look, we don't believe that men can be domestic violence victims in the same way that women are, and the only reason I was here is because they knew someone who was conducting research. A psychologist that I was referred on to when I was saying that we were having abusive fights, I was given a photocopied sheet on how to fight fair, and then we went immediately back into analysing my family history as to why this was happening.
We're talking to Nick, father of four and married to a violent partner. He's telling us his story. This is Life Matters.
It's very difficult to find help. There are no safe houses for men. And even the very few friends that I've told, I've once asked a friend to hold a go bag, which is basically full of kids' clothes and bits and pieces, my niece, and said, can you hang on to this? Because if I have to run, I'll come and get it from you so that we can at least have some things. And they refused. They did not interested and would didn't want to be involved in such a delicate, tricky situation.
Your wife has been getting help from a psychologist. Is there any prospect of this situation improving?
I think the situation is improving, partly because she is seeing a psychologist and partly because I have skilled up in how to behave and act and deal with someone who is emotionally dysregulated. So she's doing some schema therapy, and that is enabling her to rethink why these things happen. And I'm also setting down strict boundaries in that if you want to have an argument about something, you have to tell me beforehand, set a time, and that's all we're going to talk about is that one particular issue that you have and not include anything else. And if it gets out of hand, I'll just leave. Grab the kids, get out of the house for a little bit and come back to it later.
I don't know how to ask this. You've got reason to hate her. Is there any part of you that loves her?
There is a part of me that loves her, and I've had to remove that from the part of me that was trying to fix her. So, you know, I think men in particular can confuse that issue where they think that love is part of taking responsibility for the other person's actions and just accepting them. And it's very hard to screen that off and say, I can love you, but I don't have to accept this situation, and I'm going to do my damnedest to protect myself and children first, and you second.
This has been the story of your adult life from the sounds of it. How has that left you feeling as a man, all those experiences and, in a sense, the official reaction to what you've been through?
Confused. We go to church, and the attitudes towards male victims even within my own church is that we're a very small part of a huge story. And you look at the poster up on the wall, they put a poster up saying, you say no to domestic violence, and it has a picture of a man beating a woman and contact numbers below. And you see this all the time, and you feel that you're excluded almost, or discounted. That, you know, I understand that women are the majority here and need the bulk of services, but I also feel let down as a bloke in society that literally these things go on behind closed doors and we don't really want to talk about it. It becomes very difficult because you don't know what to say and when to say it, and you find yourself filtering information out so that you don't give yourself away because you're concerned about how you will be seen or that you will trigger more violence at home.
Don't the bruises on your face give it away?
No, people just stare at them. There has been one person I've worked with that actually didn't notice bruises but noticed scratches and around my neck. And I think that he was actually somebody who has been a victim as well, and he didn't say anything. All he said was, I know what you're going through. Do you want to bring the kids around and get away from it for a little bit? And that was years and years ago. Most people... At the moment, I haven't been beaten up like that for quite some time, for a few years now. But it's also you would like to say something, you would like to reach out to people, but that feeling of being stared at it just makes you feel very small. It's almost like you're being ignored.
And how do you see your future finally, Nick, when the kids are old enough? Might you leave that relationship?
It's quite possible. At the moment, I want to play it day by day and be constructive and think that it is possible to develop a, you know, a relationship that works correctly. But I'm also firmly entrenched in that I cannot fix my wife. That is entirely her responsibility. All I can deal with is myself and my children and try and support her through that process if she chooses to continue it. If things regress, then I'll just have to take it wherever I have to keep her safe. The thing that concerns me about how we're addressing domestic violence in Australia is we need to step back. At the moment, everyone's focused in maybe a little bit too tightly. Quite rightly so. I can see how that has developed. But we, from my point of view, step back, look at the problem as a whole. Because at the moment, men and their kids, for instance, are just being ignored. There have been so many times when I have wished there was somewhere that we could go where I could scoop my kids up and just go somewhere for a short, you know, for a few days, a week, whenever, until things sorted themselves out. But there just isn't that infrastructure in place. And a friend of mine is actually trying very hard to lobby the government to ask for that to happen, and he's just being stonewalled at every turn. And that's why I think we need to pull that lens back, look at the problem as a whole. It is not as easy as we're being told. It is much, much more complicated.
Violence in Australia. That was Nick, a pseudonym, a male victim of domestic violence who struggles to be heard. You're listening to Life Matters with me, Ellen Fanning.